Welcome again to students here and to students that we can see, but who can see us. You've had an opportunity to go home and prepare for this lecture, and you know that the subject that we're going to be covering today represents in the book chapters 10 through 17. The units represent a type of category of law, the negative commandments, as well as the three special laws, the super laws of Judaism, the three laws of martyrdom. This is going to be a fascinating class because we are really dealing with essentials. We're dealing with major concepts, and in order to set up the structure for this class, I'd like to use the blackboard for a moment in order to write some numbers. The first set is obvious to all of you. 613 is the most fundamental of numbers for a Jew. There are 613 mitzvot. We all know that. But we're going to break that down into two different categories. 248 and 365. Jewish law, as any system, even as directions from a parent to a child, contains within it, this is what you must do, and this is what you daren't do. In Hebrew, mitzvot aseh, and mitzvot lo saseh, do's and don'ts. Somebody once explained to me why in traffic lights, do you know which one is on top in traffic lights, the green or the red? A lot of people don't notice the red, because it is far more important to know when to stop than it is to know when to go. It doesn't make that much difference if you're not moving when you're supposed to go, but if you don't stop when you're supposed to stop, then that can be extremely dangerous. I'd like to apply that to a recognition of why there are so many more don'ts than do's. It is more important to tell you when to stop and not do something than to tell you when to do something. These numbers are significant as well in another way. It is fascinating that our sages relate the 248 number corresponding to mitzvot aseh, what you're supposed to do, to the organs of the body, and they are all identified. There are 248 evarim. It is as if every part of our body strives to do the right thing. Their positive aspects, I think I have an interesting way to describe this concept. It's Jewish acupuncture. Just like the Chinese will say that there are parts of the body which extend far more. You can touch spot and key location, and it has an effect throughout the entire body. They are even identified by Kabbalah, which ones they are and which mitzvot. 248. You know that the first Jew observed all mitzvot. He did it even before he received the Torah. How could he have done it before he received the Torah? Intuitively. It is because the organs of his body almost demanded that he live the right way. Our bodies demand that we do the right thing. The name of the first Jew was Avraham. I'd like to show you something in Gematria, the system of numbers. Aleph is 1, and Bez is 2, and Resh is 200, and He is 5, and Mem is 40. Can you give me a total on that? 248. Isn't that remarkable? Abraham's very essence, his name, bespoke the totality of the parts of his body which sought to do the right thing to fulfill the positive commandments. the 365, the don'ts, clearly relate to a number that is well known, not only to the Jew, but to the entire world. It is the accurate count of days of the year. Even though we follow a lunar calendar, that point ought to be expressed. The lunar calendar is the way in which we are told to count time for an important reason. The moon reflects symbolically the Jewish people. The moon has stages. There are times when it shines fully, and there are times when it goes down to the eye. It has its ups and downs, and so do the Jewish people have their ups and downs. We are compared to the moon, and we have our stages. But even as we use a lunar calendar, we adjust it regularly to the solar, because we know the reality is 365. And 365, therefore, is a correct number for us also. And 365, every day of the year, we are to be aware of what we dare not do. So this breakdown is significant and has a symbolic correspondence that I wanted to share with you before we proceed. So this breakdown of the numbers has a significance for us that we can readily grasp. It bespeaks two different categories, the 365 don'ts and the 248 do's, the positive and the negative, rooted in the days of the year and the organs of the body. Now, when we said that all mitzvahs are equal, we meant all positive mitzvahs, what you're supposed to do because you don't know the reward for mitzvahs. Positive commandments have rewards. Negatives have punishments. And punishments are in fact clearly indicated in the Torah, and they differ with regard to the particular crime. Hence, we know the level of severity of a crime by the intensity of the punishment. And we have basically three kinds of punishments, as I explained in the chapter in the book. I think one could just, in order to remember them, say they're the three M's, but not three M's, the three MEMS. They are Mammon, Malkot, which are lashes, and Mita, which is death. And I'd like to say something about each of these in developing ideas that I didn't have an opportunity to do in the book. First, with regard to monetary punishments or fines. When someone steals, he is obligated to pay back double. Now, when you stop and think about that, that isn't really double, but it is a fulfillment of a master principle of a concept in Jewish law, which I want to develop with you a bit further. If, I was going to say you, but I wouldn't say you. If someone were to steal $100 from me, to say that he has to give me back $100 would simply mean what? You tried and you weren't successful. Give it back. Well, try again another time. To send you to jail is not a Torah option, and I'm going to explain that to you in a while. Jail doesn't accomplish anything. Jail is too strict a punishment because it deprives you of freedom and it doesn't teach you anything. What you are supposed to do if you steal $100 is give back $200. And how does one understand a payment of $200? $200 is really pay back what you stole plus do what you did to me to yourself. You wanted to deprive me of $100, therefore you are to be deprived of $100. Have happened to you what you wanted to do to another. What do we call that principle? What is the phrase for that principle?
Mida keneged mida.
Measure for measure. Absolutely correct. We find that in the Torah in many instances. It's God's way of dealing with punishment. Do you know why the Egyptians drowned at the Red Sea? It wasn't just by accident. It wasn't just that they had to die, and therefore that was a good method for punishing them. They drowned because they had drowned Jewish babies, and therefore they had to drown.
Rabbi, why is it so important that that be the precise method of punishment?
Excellent question. And the point is, first of all, obviously it's fair. That's what you did, that's what happens to you, but it's even more than that. The Talmud is intent on emphasizing the second even more than the first. If the Egyptians would have died in any other way, if there would have been a plague of some sort, the world would have said, they might have thought, well, those are the breaks. Unfortunately, we died, but they would not have related their death to the specific crime which caused it. A measure-for-measure punishment is a clear-cut linkage between the reason for the punishment and what occurred. It is showing you why this happened. And that's what God does as he punishes people. It can be, says the Mishnah, direct, and it can even be metaphorical. And I'd like to explain that because this is such a magnificent and total concept. Samson had his eyes taken out. He was blinded. Do you know that the Mishnah says that this is a category of measure for measure? In what way? Because Samson lusted after his eyes. He strayed with his eyes concerning Philistine women. If he sinned with his eyes, then he was punished with his eyes. And it became clear, certainly to him, that the reason he was blinded was because he sinned in that regard. That's the punishment for theft, paying double. But in a whole host of instances, and the Torah describes where and when that is so, a person is to be administered lashes. And we, with Western mentality, say, how cruel, how terrible. What do we offer as alternative? Prison. And here is where I would like to clarify something where our thinking differs so significantly from Torah thought. The Torah says lashes because that is going to teach somebody something immediately. Do you know that our bodies have a remarkable system of learning what is wrong and what is right? We're not supposed to touch a hot stove. We're not supposed to put our hands into fire. When we do, what happens? Immediately, you put your hand in the fire, you withdraw it because it hurts. And when it hurts, you have learned a message. It's called stimulus response. The body knows that. The problem with prison is twofold. Usually, by the time a person is sent to prison, he forgets what for. I'm not being facetious. I mean, there is so much of a time period between the crime and the punishment that they're not linked directly. A person feels he can get away with it for a long time. Eventually, he may be sentenced, but it is not immediate, and hence, it is not a stimulus response kind of learning experience. Penologists today say there is too much uncertainty as to whether a person will be sent to jail, and there is no direct link, no time link for it to be effective. Do you know that with regard to children, there is a remarkable law in halacha? You are never allowed to say to your child, you did something terrible, wait until daddy gets home, he'll punish you. Not just because you're saying wait until daddy, and daddy is the one who's going to become the disciplinarian, but because too much time has elapsed between the crime, the bad thing that was done, to the patch. And the kid doesn't understand. I don't know why at 10 o'clock at night I'm being slapped. What did I do to deserve this? They're not together one with another. Malkut must be immediate. Malkut must be given right away. And after Malkut, the person is to be treated as if he is now a regular member of society who has done no wrong because he has paid his punishment. Prison, one can languish for years, but with regard to Malkut, it says, V'nikla achicha li'enecha, and your brother shall be demeaned to your eyes. Watch this. Achicha, your brother, it could simply have said, and he shall be demeaned before your eyes. Why do we call him your brother? Because once he has paid for his crime by receiving the lashes, he is to be considered your brother. He is now back in the fold. Achicha in gematria, I love gematria, is 1 and 8 and 10 and 20, and the total is 39. Do you know how many lashes are administered in that punishment of Malkut? 39 lashes. But I'd like to discuss something with you, and this is very crucial and very interesting. The Torah, when it tells us this punishment, says 40 lashes. Mispar Arboim. And yet, oral law says 30. 9. Isn't that strange? Why do we do 39 instead of 40? Well, the answer is tradition. The answer is that's what oral law teaches us. That's not good enough. I'd like to know why the text says 40 and then why we do 39. Could you tell me, what does the number 40 refer to usually, symbolically, throughout the Torah? Can you think of any incidents in the Torah where 40 is significant? Yes.
Noah, the rain for 40 days and 40 nights.
The rains 40 days and 40 nights. And what did that do? In 40 days and 40 nights, let's identify clearly, there was a change in the world. Evil had to be removed, and it was a different world. 40. What else? You had another possibility?
Moses on Har Sinai.
Moses on Mount Sinai. Moses went up to Mount Sinai and he was there for 40 days and 40 nights. I want to emphasize the key to that experience. And that is how he became changed and found the vehicle for changing the Jewish people. 40 days and 40 nights. What else can you think of?
There was 40 years in the desert after the Chet Amaraglim.
After the sin of the spies, they were in the desert for 40 years. I want to again clarify conceptually what that means. They had to create a new generation because the old generation obviously wasn't ready for freedom and for entry into Israel. We had to wait 40 until we had a change and a new people. The old died and a new were born. But I want to get to an even more fundamental one. I wonder if any of you can recall a 40 that has to do with birth itself.
40 days or before a child is born, I think God is saying to his married, to his going to marry.
Yes. 40 days before Yetzirat Havlad, a bat kol, a heavenly voice goes forth and proclaims so-and-so to so-and-so. But the reason for that is because in the first 40 days, we say, a child isn't a child. It's not even a fetus yet. It's mayim biyalma. It's just water. I know that we're opposed to abortion, terribly opposed to abortion. But there are times when it is permitted. We won't go into details now because it's a lengthy issue. We are far more lenient in the first 40 days because in the first 40 days, it isn't human yet. It takes 40 days to create a fetus. 40. Interesting. 40 creates something that is new and viable. 40 creates life. Just a moment. What is the key to life? Both science teaches us this and the Jewish religion teaches us this. What is the key to life? You can't have life without?
Yes. Water?
Water. Water. Water is the key to life. Mayim chayim. Now, I don't know if you're aware of this, but letters are also words. The word mayim is a letter. And the letter is mem, and mem is a number. 40. When you want to change your life and become a convert, you have to go into mayim, water. How much water must you go into? 40 sa. That's a measurement, a liquid measurement. 40. 40 keeps appearing as the number, and what do you see as the constant thread that unites all these illustrations that I've given you? 40 is a change, a new kind of life. After the flood, a new kind of existence. Moshe Rabbeinu Torah, new existence, fetus life. I understand that now. And what are we trying to do? When we take a person who committed a terrible crime and we give him lashes, we want to change him, give him a new life, allow him to become a tzaddik, a righteous person. And so the number that is given is 40, yes, but we don't give 40. So I've answered part of the question, but I haven't really answered it because we still have a problem. We give him 39. But Salah, you have a question.
Yes, I would like to ask why they're giving 39, Malkus, and not 40.
That's a wonderful question if the key, as we're saying now, is the number 40. Let's jump for a moment to another area where we find 40, but actually the 40 becoming 39. We know that on Shabbat there are a number of things that we are forbidden to do. They are creative acts. We are not permitted to create because God created and rested on the seventh day. We too are to rest and not do new creative acts. How many things are we forbidden to do on Shabbat? How many melachot, works, creative acts, are forbidden on Sabbath?
39.
39 is the correct answer. But what is fascinating is that when the Talmud gives us the answer, it doesn't say 39, it says
40 minus 1.
How peculiar. If the correct answer is 39, why doesn't it say 39? Again, using the number 40, but bringing it down to 39, just as we find in Malkut. There must be a link, and I'll tell you what it is. God created the world with many acts. The first one, however, was unique because before God formed things, initially he had to create yesh me'ayin, something out of nothing. He had to do an act of creation which no man, no human being can duplicate. We can't really create. All we can do is take things that already exist and reshape them, form them, turn them into something else. But we can't create. Only God can create. God's 40 represent one act of creation and 39 acts of formation. When we, as human beings, are told that we are not permitted to do work on Shabbat, what that means is we cannot do Arba'im 40 minus 1, minus the initial one that God did, which we cannot do simply because it is impossible for us to do. We can't create. The other acts of formation are the ones that we might do on the Sabbath, and they are forbidden to us. Let's apply that now to the category of Malkus, and I want to show you something absolutely fascinating. What you're trying to do is to change a person. Change is 40. Change him because he has gone astray, because his body has acted in a way that is reprehensible. You have to change almost everything about him except one part of a human being, which, just like in the creation story, came from God vis-a-vis the world. Only God can create and do the initial aspect of what there is in the world, yesh me'ayin, something out of nothing. Only God can create a neshama, a soul. And that soul surely did not sin. It was the person who distorted his inner essence who committed a crime. And you know what you therefore have to correct, fix out of the 40? 40 minus 1. Don't fix the neshama. The neshama itself, its core, your essence is pure and holy. What was perverted were the other 39 aspects of further development. That's a remarkable concept. Now, I said to you that we have Malkut, but we don't have prison. I gave you some reasons, and the book has some reasons why. Prison is not an acceptable option. But I want to explain one more idea, which I didn't have an opportunity to develop in the text. You know what the first mitzvah is that is given to the Jewish people? I don't mean to an individual Jew, that would be Abraham. I mean to the Jewish people as a nation. The mitzvah is HaChodesh Hazeh Lochem Rosh Chodoshim. It is chapter 12 in the book of Shemot, Exodus. God says, this month is to you the first of months. Implicit in that law is something deeper. HaChodesh Hazeh Lochem, this month is to you. You are to determine when a month is a month. The way in which we decided when to start Rosh Chodesh, the beginning of a month, was via witnesses who came. And they testified, we saw the new moon. If they didn't come to court, even if we saw it, it's not Rosh Chodesh. What is the significance of that? But reality is reality. Our sages teach us there is a fantastic concept here. Time is to be determined by us. We are to control time. HaChodesh Hazeh Lochem, this month is to you. To you it is given. You are to determine time, and time is not to control you. Stop and think for a moment. I would like this to be an item of discussion. You are to control time. Time is not to control you. Do you recognize how all important that principle is? You are the master of your time. Time doesn't control you, but you control time. You determine what you do with your life. Do you know that the most important thing in your life, the only thing that is irreplaceable, not your car and not your money, the only thing that is irreplaceable is time. Who is master over time? People who say, well, I don't have the time. Make the time, I can't make the time. That means time controls them. The very first mitzvah given to the Jewish people is HaChodesh Hazeh Lochem. You are to indicate that you determine and define time. You are in control of your time. That means you're in control of your life. You're in control of your destiny. Time belongs to you, not the reverse. When the Jews were slaves, what was that problem? What was the problem of Egypt? You will say to me they had to work hard. I know many people who work hard. People are exhausted all over the world. The United States today suffers from exhaustion, physical exhaustion. That wasn't the problem. That's not what creates a slave. When God was about to take the Jews out of slavery, he explained to us what their real crime of slavery was. It wasn't that you had to do work for somebody. It was that you weren't in control of your own time. Do you realize that on the eve of the Jewish people being taken out of the slavery of Egypt, they were given a mitzvah, the very first mitzvah, which said to them, I want you to be free men, I want you to be free people, and therefore time is to belong to you. You control time and not the reverse. That's the significance for HaChodesh Hazeh Lochem being the very first mitzvah given to the Jews as they were going to depart from Egypt. You're not going to be slaves any longer. Not you're not going to work hard. We still work hard. You will determine how you spend your time. You decide to spend your time by listening to a lecture and by learning Torah, and you can find the time, then you control your time. If you can't find the time, you just don't have the time. It means your life is not your own. That's the most crucial mitzvah there is, the first mitzvah to the Jewish people. Jail is too severe a punishment. We give malchus, we don't send someone to prison. Isn't that interesting? And the Western mind says, but how can you be so cruel? Why don't you send them to jail? And we say, how could you be so cruel and send them to jail and deprive him of time? Hit him and teach him, perhaps, but not remove a person from that which is most precious and irreplaceable, the only thing in life that we have that can't be replaced, and that is time. What a magnificent concept. And so therefore, Malkot is preferable to prison, although it doesn't seem to be so for Western mentality.
What about those individuals that are dangerous to society where you would not want them to move around freely because they might kill someone and hurt someone?
Granted. Obviously, Jewish law recognizes that fear and that problem. and that is taken care of, but there the prison sentence is not to be viewed as punishment per se. You may have to remove someone from society to protect others, but you can't punish someone by saying, we give you 10 years. Really? 10 years? What do you mean you give me 10 years? You deprive me of 10 years. And there is no such thing in Judaism. The section on the laws of martyrdom unfortunately became extremely relevant during the time of the Holocaust. Yes, there are specific sins for which law dictates better to die than to violate. They are ultimates of our faith. In Hebrew, as you saw in the text, they are called the Gimel Yehoreg V'Al Ya'avor, the three better to die than to transgress. People asked questions of rabbis during that horrible time period. There are books that have always moved me in terms of shelot utshuvot, questions and responses during that era, where people wanted to know what they had to do from a religious perspective. They would ask rabbis, and they would very often do what they were commanded to do by law. And quite often, it was the option of death. Yes, Benjamin.
With these laws of martyrdom and things that you can't do, even if it, you know, things you have to sacrifice your life for, that means people in the Holocaust had to give up their lives for these certain things?
That's such a fascinating question, because at first glance, the answer would be, yes, that's the law. That's what we're talking about. That's what's discussed in the book, and this goes back to biblical sources. There are times when it is preferable to choose death over life. But I'm so glad you asked that question, because there was a remarkable answer given by a number of gedolim, of spiritual giants, during the time of the Holocaust. A daring decision which took note of a new reality that I have to share with you. There were a number of sages who said, what we have to understand is what the goal of those who seek to destroy us is. If they want to destroy us spiritually, and that was the case in many times throughout our history, then we must stand firm and say, we will not allow you to do that to us. We will abide by our religious principles. We will die rather than violate. But in the time of the Holocaust, there was a different goal. The goal was not simply to destroy the Jewish people spiritually. The goal was, the intent was, the purpose was to destroy the Jewish people, that there not be a remnant. If they wanted to see to it that we do not remain alive, not a one, la hashmidu, la harigu, la abed es kol hayehudim, the phrase that we use with regard to the Purim experience, the genocide number one from Haman, if they wanted to eliminate every single Jew, then the mitzvah of the Jew became what? Their lives, to remain alive. Then there is a new mitzvah for the Jewish people. We have got to respond to the nature of the threat. It is so fascinating that we always have recognized there are two distinct types of threats. You know the two holidays, Hanukkah and Purim? On Hanukkah, there was an attempt to destroy us spiritually, which is why, since we survived spiritually, we light candles. Candles are a symbol of the soul. The soul survived longer than it should have. The oil lasted longer than it should. The soul praises God. But on Purim, when they sought to destroy us physically, then we rejoice by having a meal. We rejoice because our bodies rejoice. We're still here. We can still eat and drink. The method of observance takes cognizance of the different threat. It would be interesting for further discussion to try to analyze the nature of various threats throughout our history, including modern times. What is the intent of what was the intent of Russia with regard to the Jews? They wanted to destroy us. Yes, that's correct. But they wanted to destroy us spiritually. What is the intent of the Arabs? They want to destroy us, as they say, to destroy us physically. One would have to analyze every situation and see what the motivation is, and what an amazing and daring concept in the time of the Holocaust that a number of sages expressed. Our mission is to live, and martyrdom is a principle and a religious imperative in terms of maintaining our spiritual status of purity. When that is the goal of our enemies, to destroy us spiritually, if they don't want us to live, then our mitzvah is to continue to live. The psak, the decision for this generation and for this time, is we must live. You want us to die? No, Am Yisrael Chai, we will survive.
Rabbi Bach, I'd just like to share something with you that I heard from my mother, who is a survivor, and she told me how in the camps they tried to treat the Jews and all the other inmates in the camps as animals, and she said what one of the things they're trying to do is make them act as animals. And she told me many times that they refused to act as animals. They shared food with each other. She told me an instance once where her uncle, seeing her on the other side of the fence, threw his last piece of bread to her just to be able to see that she got enough food, which tells you how not only did the Jews manage to survive as physical beings, but also as spiritual beings.
And Ari confirms precisely the point in a magnificent way. Then our responsibility was to do precisely the opposite of what they wanted to impose upon us. You will be animals. If that was their statement, then our response must be, we will not be animals. We will be human, fully human. Exactly. A perfect illustration. In that last chapter that you had read concerning the name Yisrael as opposed to Yaakov, I just wanted to make one final observation that I think is powerful and significant for us today. Yaakov is the Jew who was on the run. Yaakov, from the word heel, he always fled, didn't confront a situation but ran from it. Yisrael means fighter for God. Today, we have the land of Israel. It is called Yisrael, and Yisrael acknowledges a new vision and a new understanding of our destiny. Yisrael means the Jew who acknowledges that there is a time when we must fight for what we believe in. It is true that as Jews, we would hope that we wouldn't have to fight. Koheles, Ecclesiastes, said it well. There's a time for peace and a time for war. The man of peace is Yaakov. The man who fights is Yisrael. I know that we speak of the God of our fathers, the God of Abram, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob, and that Yaakov, Jacob, is the way in which we would like to be forever and ever. But in a world of reality, which contains those who seek to destroy us, there are times when we have to be Yisrael. This is one of those times. We need to be Israel, fighters for our beliefs, in order to protect our survival, so that the time may come when we can be Yaakov, who is designated in the Torah as Ish Tam Yoshev Aholim, the man of the tents, the man of wholeness and perfection, who is able to sit and study Torah. That's the ideal. There is reality and there is ideal. Reality is Yisrael. Ideal is Yaakov. Let's close the session today, and we will continue, please God, next week with a very important discussion on the chapters to come. Please, all of you, prepare with your readings, and we will meet again following week.